I'm going to give you two words.
Okay.
Be bold. Be bold. We live in a world of sheep.
Yeah.
Boldness, conviction. You know, we're being told constantly that if you have a closely held opinion about anything, keep it to yourself. Right. Don't offend anybody.
Right.
Nonsense. The greatness of the world has always been the discourse of ideas.
Welcome to the Disruption Zone. Opportunity lives where the status quo dies. Talking to the greatest innovators, disruptors, and off-the-wall inventors we can scrounge up. You laugh, you'll learn, you'll be inspired. Now, here are your hosts, Leland Conway and Cameron Mills.
Welcome again into the Disruption Zone. Leland Conway along with Cameron Mills. And we have conversations that are interesting and compelling with interesting and compelling people. And we have got the governor of the state of Kentucky.
The Commonwealth of Kentucky.
Yeah, get it straight.
That's right. Governor Matt Bevin. There's only two commonwealths, right? It's Virginia and Kentucky.
Massachusetts.
Okay.
Virginia.
Pennsylvania?
Kentucky and Pennsylvania.
Yes, exactly. All right, the fourth commonwealth. What's the difference?
Well, there really, what does
it mean? I'll let you
speak. I don't know. I was going to ask you.
There really is, and it goes back to a day. It is a structure under which the state came into formation, but trust me, we're no different than any of the other 50 stars on the flag.
So it's paperwork.
It is a structure. It's different.
It rolls off the tongue better.
Kind of Commonwealth sounds a little highfalutin, doesn't it?
Yeah, I agree.
Fancy.
There's nothing wrong with a little fancy every now and then.
No,
I like
we're
that.
Those kind of people.
Yeah. Not according to the rest of the country.
We are both a state and just incorporated as a Commonwealth.
Excellent. All right. Well, Governor Matt Bevin, and what's interesting about your career is you ran for Senate, and you got beat pretty good by the sitting senator, and then you came back and ran for governor. And you won the primary by just an inch or so, and then you walked away with the governorship. And that kind of the innovation that it takes and the grit and the determination is very fascinating to us that you were able to pull that off. And now here you sit leading the Commonwealth of Kentucky.
You know, it's interesting. I mean, the title of your show, The Disruption Zone, the reason I ran for any office in the first place was to be a disruptor, not for the sake of pure disruption. And while, yes, I was beaten fairly handily in that primary, in the history of America, and I knew this going into this, I'm a person who's a student of history. I do my homework. No Senate leader, majority leader, minority leader, whip, anybody in Senate leadership had ever in the history of America lost a primary for election. Nobody ever. Only four times has anybody ever lost a general election. So I knew going in that the odds were, you know, statistically impossible. Additionally, no seated leader had ever gotten less than 75% of the vote in a primary ever in history.
Wow.
And so to barely get 60, and with all due respect to our leader, I mean, the reality is my job was in that instance to bring the voice to things that needed to be discussed, to represent the fact that a government of and by and for the people needs to truly represent the people, and to challenge the notion that career politicians should be an accepted way of life. And again, maybe if that is the best person, and the people of Kentucky felt that he was, and they elected him overwhelmingly, that's their prerogative.
Right.
And I was there simply just to disrupt the notion that we don't really have a voice. And I wanted to make sure that people were heard.
You're basically, I mean, you're a business dude. I mean, before
sure. Right. It's not a politician.
Oh, no, I'm telling you, I had a good anonymous life. I could go to dinner without being told that I was evil.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I mean, literally.
Wait, so you can't do that now?
No, sadly, I've avoided the little red hen. But in all seriousness, I went to school in that town in Lexington, Virginia. So
how hard has that been to make that adjustment? To go from a successful businessman to now. One way or the other, regardless of what you do, one side's going to hold you as a pariah.
Right. The state's going to be pissed half the time.
People, and invariably, the people who will hate you the most will know you the least. But that's the world in which we live. We live in a soundbite, social media-driven, anonymized world where just soundbites and anecdotes drive things. And so, of course, you're going to be hated. I'm blessed to be wired to not care.
Okay.
But your question about how hard it is, harder for my wife and children.
I bet.
Especially for my wife. It's hard for somebody that you love to be pilloried all the time. And from my standpoint, I just ignore it. I really do. I've never lived my life for the impression of ill-informed people. I just haven't. If constructive criticism comes, then I will take it as such and take it to heart. But if it's mindless, driven by non-facts, yeah, I just ignore it.
You say, though, it's how you're wired. And I want to get into this. Leland, I've talked about the questions for you. We just watched the video a few minutes ago about specifically the workforce requirement that you talked about. And you started getting choked up when you talked about the dignity of work. And we'll get to that. But what I want to talk about is your dad. Because you said in that moment that it's something your dad said to you. And I wonder, what is it like? I've got so many questions about this line. My dad's sitting in there right now. I mean, talk about a disruptor. That's what fathers are supposed to be to their sons and their children as a whole. In what ways did your father raise you? In what ways do you see you now as the governor of Kentucky? You're like, you know what? This is my dad coming out in me.
My father was several things. Number one, he's probably the most non-materialistic person I've ever met. And not in an earthy, crunchy, you know, hug the earth kind of way, but I mean, just a guy who was never motivated by financial things, understood the importance of them, the significance of not having debt and of paying your way. But yeah, but he was always a very simple guy financially that way. We never had any means. We always lived well below the poverty level, but so did a lot of people. But he always had an amazing work ethic. I mean, he could have been a Spartan, literally. I mean, he could have been. He might, you know, if I believed in reincarnation, I'd believe that he had been coming back as having been a Spartan at some point in time. The reality is this: he had an incredible work ethic, and he always had these little sayings, and he would always tell us, you know, suck it up. He would literally, like, if we complained about something, he would say, suck it up, take it like a man.
Yeah.
It's character building.
Sure.
He would always call hard things character building. And he would tell us, always give an honest day's work for an honest day's pay. Don't ever take something that you didn't earn. These were things that he infused in us, and at key moments in time when they really resonated, because when you're a teenager, you invariably roll your eyes and pretend not to listen anyway, but they stayed with me.
Because you know more as a teenager than your father does.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, talk about the government cheese.
Yeah.
You mentioned, don't take anything you didn't earn.
Yeah, I mean, my dad was a guy who we didn't take government cheese, and many people did. It came in these long rectangular boxes. Yeah. It was good. We ate it at our friend's house.
Yeah.
It made great grilled cheese sandwiches.
Yes,
actually,
it
was kind of like Velveeta type cheese, and we liked it. And I asked my dad one time. I said, "Why don't we get the government cheese?" And that's when he said, "Don't ever take something that you didn't earn." It served a good purpose. There was nothing wrong with cheese, and there was nothing intended to be dismissive of those who had taken it. But what he was essentially saying to me is that in this home, you make your way, you work as you go, and you find your own path. You don't rely on other people to give you things if you could earn things yourself.
My dad had a saying that annoyed the crap out of me, and it was, anything worth doing is worth doing right the first time.
Yeah.
And his message was, if it's worth spending any time on at all, then you don't want to have to do it over. But that was annoying to me when I was growing up. And now it's like everything I do that same way. It's like you got to get it right.
Is that why this very interview is being backed up twice?
That's exactly right.
Okay.
That's exactly right. If it's worth doing.
I want to make sure.
Three different microphones.
Yeah.
You know what's interesting? When I was an officer in the military, I came home. I'll tell you a quick anecdote. I came home. It was in the wintertime. I had a rental car. My parents lived in northern New Hampshire up near the Canadian border, freezing cold. We didn't have a garage, never did. So you had to start your car at about midnight, run it for about 20 minutes, seriously, where the battery would freeze and it would not start in the morning. So he and I were up late talking. It was about 12, 1 o'clock in the morning. We thought, oh, we better go out and start the car. So we did. We went out. Mine barely cranked over, and it was a brand new rental car, and it barely cranked. His did not crank. So it was just plain. And so we were jump starting this car. And to make a long story short, it was so cold, literally, that the leather gloves, the bit of moisture in the leather would freeze. So it was like they were made of wood. You couldn't even bend your fingers. So you had to take your gloves off, and they immediately begin to freeze. And we're under the hood, and the wind was howling. And my dad, you know, was like sucking up his breath, like, that was my dad complaining. He never said anything. He just made the sound that would be like my dad complaining. And
oh,
so
he's
I
mad
jokingly,
now.
And I looked at him and I yelled at him under the hood so I could be heard above the wind and the snow flying by. And I said, "Dad, look at it this way. It's character building." He said to me then was, all those years that I said it was character building, it was a euphemism for the fact that it's a real pain in the keister,
right,
and there's nothing we can do about it.
Yeah.
And that was a powerful lesson. too, that he said it with good humor, but he's like, you're old enough now, I can level with you. And it was true. All the times he'd said it, complaining didn't change anything. Right. You can complain about the fact that the car we drove, which cost $100, did not have a defroster. And so the kid who rode shotgun literally had to scrape the inside of the windshield as we drove and had to breathe inside your shirt. You could complain about it, but if you did, my dad would say, suck it up. Right. It's character building.
What was the most annoying thing your dad said to you?
Sounds like his sit-up.
We're kind of zoning in on that one. I mean, he would when in the morning on summer vacation, because we raised crops and animals and pretty much everything we ate, we grew or raised ourselves. And so we were always working. And so, like, summer vacation, kids look forward to summer because then they get, you know, a break.
Right.
In our house, you got up early and worked hard. And he would have these – he would always have these names. Like, if you were going to expand the amount of land that we were farming, he would call it Expandoguard. So he would say, okay, up and at him. Let's quick, like a bunny. Let's go up and at him. Everybody rise and shine. Expandoguard. Everybody up. And so it would be like you were off to something fun.
That's irritating. I'm irritated right now. Oh, just listen to
but
that.
But here's the thing. I didn't begrudge it. I probably did. But in hindsight, you look back and you're grateful. I'll say one thing real quick about my mother, too. I remember when I was a teenager, we'd had no central heat in our home. We had these little wood stoves, and she would get up every morning at 5:30 in the morning, start these little stoves from scratch because my dad, being frugal as he was, would never allow us to stoke them up at night. So they'd go out every night. Mm. And she'd go in there and start them from scratch with these blue tip diamond, you know, matches. And she would try to get the thing fired up. And we were standing there. I got up early that morning. It was the two of us. And I remember she said, Matt, all you brothers and sisters are different. All you kids are different. There's six. I was the second of six. She said, and your father and I, we don't care exactly what you do. We don't care exactly what you pursue in life, because you're all going to do different things. She said, just make sure that at the end of every day, you give back more than you take. And I'll tell you, to have been raised by a father who taught us not to take something we didn't earn, to be raised by a mother who taught us to give back more than we took, what a powerful combination. How blessed I was, as simple and humble as upbringing it was financially, to be raised by people with good, strong principles, Judeo-Christian principles, good work ethic. I mean, I was blessed beyond measure.
But what is the most, how many kids do you have?
I have 9 children.
Okay. What is the most annoying thing you say to them?
Most of the very same things that I just told you. I don't know. I mean, you turn off the lights. That's a big pet peeve of mine.
That goes back to not wasting.
There's a lot of kids flicking lights on, leaving fans on. You know, I too am frugal. My wife has other words for it. I like to think of myself as frugal.
Yeah.
And I get that from my parents. And part of it is...
So your wife calls you cheap. You say you're frugal.
I say frugal. Yeah, I'm not going to say she said that, but it might rhyme with that. It sound exactly the same. But here's the thing. I mean, you think we're a function of how we're wired. And I'm always mindful. Like my grandmother, who passed away recently at 103, was a product of the Great Depression. You know, she was a teenager during the Great Depression. And she was always colored by that. And I look back, I look even at how I am now, I'm a bit the same way.
Are your parents still with us?
They are. Yeah, they've moved to Kentucky, as have half of my
siblings.
Well,
they should have.
Yeah, everyone does. I mean, as Daniel Boone duly noted, surely heaven must be a Kentucky kind of place. And it really is, I'm telling you. And so since I moved here, one of my sisters and her family, my brother and his family, my parents have moved here. One of my other sisters is thinking of moving here. So it's a special place.
Let's talk about your kids.
Yeah.
You have 9. How many of them are adopted?
We have 4 of our children that were adopted and 5 that were born to us.
Why? Why?
It's interesting. To make a longer story less long,
you can make it long. We got time.
It's interesting. We lost our oldest child actually when she was a senior in high school. A lot of people don't realize that she was our oldest daughter was killed in an automobile accident when she was 17.
I never heard that.
And she was a child who was an only child to us for many years. And we didn't think we could have more kids. And sometimes you got to be careful what you pray for because, you know, God has a sense of humor.
Yes,
and when they did start coming, they started coming like little rabbits. but that said, so we thought maybe we couldn't. And so we decided to start the adoption process. This was many, many years ago, 20 years ago. And we started this adoption process, and one thing led to another, and we ended up finding out that we were expecting. So we stopped the adoption process, and then we had a couple more, and then another one, and then another one. But we had always remembered this. I had always had a heart for adoption and for orphans. I don't know why. When I was a kid, I read about the boxcar children and a little girl named Clematis and the five little peppers who had a mom but not a dad. And I was always heartbroken for kids who didn't have a mom and a dad. And I don't know why. The first time I remember someone asking me, what do you want to do when you grow up? I remember saying I wanted to own an orphanage. And I was just a kid.
Yeah.
So for some reason, that was always in my mind. And so I had never forgotten this. My wife had a similar heart and passion. There's 167 million orphans in the world.
Yeah, wow.
And so long story short, we just decided, you know what? Let's dust this back off and look at this process. We have five kids. They haven't made us crazy yet. So maybe we can handle this. So we initially intended to adopt one child, which we did. In the course of adopting him, we learned of a sibling group of three, not his siblings, but related to one another. And we modified our paperwork, and it wasn't a given that it would happen. But we said, you know, 6-9, what's the difference at this point?
Yeah.
So we already had six. We were already playing zone, to say the very least. And so it ended up being approved, and then we adopted these three children. They were 2, 7, and 10. Mm. So most
those three are all related.
Yes, they are related to one another. Yeah. And they have at least the same mom, and they were all together at that time. They were not able to find a home for them,
right?
And especially because of their ages, and there were so many. And so we've been very blessed. And now they became number 7, 8, and 9.
Yeah,
and we've got quite the crew.
My mom and dad. This is when I decided, because you think about you say you don't know why. You've got a heart, because it's heartbreaking. That's why kids that don't. I mean, think about what you said about your parents, and to have kids that don't grow up. My parents became my heroes. They were already my heroes, but became even more so when they adopted two little girls. Now, they brought chaos into the home, because these were special needs adoptions, and adoption by itself is bringing chaos into the home because the home's established. But it's when they did that, I thought, okay, I get it. There's something special about these people who are simply saying, we got to do more, and we can do more.
I'll tell you, too, what people often ask us about. I had a funny incident when we were first adopting. I told somebody who was clearly geographically challenged that we had adopted some children. They said, where are they from? And I told them, you know, from Ethiopia is where they were born. And they said, you know, do they look just like you? I mean, would we be able to tell they're adopted? Some people, they look just like you. And I said, well, you know, they do look just like us. They're a little more tan than we are.
Right,
but they do look like. Yeah. And this person said, oh, wait a minute, where's Ethiopia? So and the point of people sometimes ask, why did you adopt children of a different race than yourselves? And it wasn't the intent necessarily to do that. But we were not at all. We were very open to the idea of it. And I will tell you, honestly, one thing that has come of it that I'm grateful for is that it is an immediately visible billboard for what society could and should look like from within a single family.
Yeah.
You know, the fact that there shouldn't be any kind of dissension in the ranks based on someone's color or where they're from. And so for me, nobody looks at our family and thinks these certain children were born to us. It's immediately obvious that some were adopted. And guess what it does? It breaks down the inhibition to talk about adoption.
Yeah.
It breaks down the stereotype and the concern about whether or not it should be a topic of conversation, because it's right out there for everybody to see. And America needs it. Kentucky needs it. And our communities need us as people who have the capacity in any way, shape, or form. Maybe it's to actually adopt someone, as your parents did, as we have done. Maybe it's to come alongside somebody and say, listen, I'll just provide you a weekend so you can get away. I'll watch your kids for a weekend. Maybe it's to come over and provide a meal or two, or just take kids for an afternoon to come play with my kids. There's a lot of ways you can come along and support families who want to foster and adopt.
Yeah.
And it's a passion of mine and a passion of my wife's.
Did you foster first?
We did. It's, boy, again.
We got time.
It's just the fifth time I said it's a long story, but it's, all these things are. We tried to adopt in Kentucky more than 10 years ago out of the foster care system, and it didn't work. After more than a year, all the paperwork, all the fingerprints, all the classes, being taught how to be a parent, even though we had five children at that point in time, including being taught how to be a parent by someone who had no children. And
well, that
reading,
makes sense.
And was reading out of a book.
Yeah.
You know, and seriously, nice. And I don't mean to pick on him. She was well-intended, but it was just, I thought, this is crazy.
Yeah.
And after more than a year of this, and all the in-home inspections and interviews of our children and of us and all these things, the intrusion of it, the financial cost, all of it, it was then determined by a state worker that, you know what, you have enough kids. And it's better for this little girl who was 11 years old.
Yeah, this is crazy.
She was 11 years old, had never had a home, had been in, I think, 14 different homes, had never had any stability, was eligible to be adopted, wanted to be adopted. It was determined by a state bureaucrat that it was better for her to stay in the system than to be the sixth child in a family because she wouldn't get enough attention.
Yeah.
And I remember just being outraged for her. And even now it just breaks my heart because she's a young adult somewhere. Statistically, it probably has not worked out well for her. And to me, it breaks my heart. And I just said even then, more than a decade ago, if I could ever do something about it.
Well, and you said you were one of six children yourself, right?
I was
number two. So, I mean, so did you grow up thinking you were, you didn't get, I mean, you've already told us how much attention your dad gave you.
Sometimes I got more attention.
Exactly. That's what
I mean, sometimes I got attention at both ends.
Yeah.
You know, and, more than I would have ever wanted.
What, you've been governor now for 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
You strike me as the kind of person, just kind of knowing a little bit about your background, knowing your father, the way I think I know him, that you're constantly learning, that you never feel like, okay, I know enough to handle my job right now, which I can't imagine. This, you've been 2 years on this job. Yeah. What's one thing you've learned 2 years in that you wish you could tell Matt Bevin 2 years ago?
I am intellectually curious. It's what I always seek when I'm hiring people in the private sector and in this job as well. I want people that continue to learn, that are intellectually curious. What would I say? You're going to need to be more patient than you even think you do. Mm. I came in thinking I would need to be patient, thinking the pace of government was ridiculously slow, thinking the bureaucracy was suffocating. And I wasn't even close to recognize how all of the above was even more so.
Is that intentional, the pace? Is it something that you feel like we need to change, that we need to disrupt?
Oh.
Or is it something that's just the way government is?
The title of this show, of disrupt. Yeah. I mean, what has changed everything? Why are we not burning candles in here and we have light bulbs? I mean, because somebody somewhere has always been willing to disrupt.
But we do have a glowing salt rock.
We do have a glowing salt rock.
To be fair, we're not sure why that's here.
We don't.
Yeah, it does have a little engineer's cap on it. I wish you all on the radio could see this odd thing. I will tell you, you think you know what it looks like. It's bigger than any you've ever seen before.
Yeah.
As big as your head. It's like burrito as big as your head. I remember when I moved to Louisville 20 years ago, I was struck by that over on Bardstown Road. There's a little boy, burritos as big as your head.
Yeah, we had one of those in Lexington.
I never did actually have one, but I was always mesmerized.
They're actually bigger than your head, depending on the size of your head. Yeah, they're pretty large.
Yeah.
Outstanding.
Well, let's talk about managing disruption then, because you as a politician have been disruptive, like you said. And yet you're also a business guy who knows management. So, and maybe we can tie this to your kids. You know, when you adopt into a family that has kids already, that's a disruption.
Yeah.
So what are the lessons you take from managing disruption? You intentionally wanted to sort of upend the old system of doing things.
Have to.
But you still have to manage the state while you're upending things. So what's the lesson there?
If you come in simply to destroy things without a game plan as to how you will improve upon them or replace them, you end up with chaos. It's interesting, Thomas Edison, we were just talking about light bulbs, once duly noted that most people in life miss opportunity. He said, because it usually shows up in overalls and looks like hard work.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the truth. And you think about this, to be disruptive as he was and as I've attempted to do, on the political front, you have to be willing to break some eggs. But you better have a frying pan and have a plan as to what kind of omelet you're going to make
right.
with those broken. Otherwise, you end up with a mess, a sticky mess on the floor. And I will say this. One of the first things I did is I came in, I said, I'm going to cut 30% of all the red tape and all the regulations in this state. Now, guess who hates red tape? Everybody.
Right.
Liberals hate it. Conservatives hate it. Yeah. Everybody hates it.
Anybody who's run into it.
Anybody who's ever run into it. Now, they have different ideas of which is the worst kind of red tape. But the point is, I got 150 people together in a room and said, tell me your ideas. I set up a website, redtapereduction.com, and we opened it up to everyone and said, tell us what is suffocating you. We'll do what we can to eliminate it. We've eliminated hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of regulations, which are comprised of thousands of rules.
Right.
130,000 rules in Kentucky when I was elected, telling people what they could or could not do. Mm. 130,000 plus. So there's plenty of room for people who think we're going to compromise safety or security or the environment or anything of this sort by getting rid of 30%. We'll still have 95,000 rules telling everyone.
And isn't a lot of that too just you're changing things, and we just naturally are afraid of change because today we feel safe. If you change things, we may not feel safe tomorrow.
If you remember when I ran, I was the only one willing to put in writing what I would do. I put in writing things that were intentionally disruptive, things like right to work, things like getting rid of the prevailing wage, things like bringing school choice to Kentucky and some of our inner cities' failing school systems, you know, things like cutting regulation, These are the types of things that, frankly, nobody thought were smart things to run a political campaign on or ways to get elected. But I intentionally put them out there, and I put them out there in writing, and I simply said, if people don't want this, don't vote for me. If you do want it, understand I am going to disrupt in these areas. Yeah. And so, frankly, the people of Kentucky want it. They don't like it. No one likes change,
right.
But people aren't stupid. And we know when all of us, within our families, within our schools, within our clubs and communities, within our state, within our lives, no matter what we do, we know when something's not working right. We know when there's a better way. We always want someone to step up and do it. But most of us as human beings are not wired to lead. Even people in leadership positions often like the idea of being a leader as long as there's at least one person in front of them.
Mm. So what's the difference then? What is it being willing to bear the burden of looking around the horizon? Is
yeah,
that
you
it?
Have to do. It's interesting. I used to be an active duty Army officer. I learned a lot of lessons, one of which was you lead by example. You have to be willing to get kicked in the teeth first.
Yeah.
You get kicked first and you eat last. I mean, these are the kind of things, literally. You have to be willing to. That's what drives respect. That's what drives true change. That's what drives loyalty in the kind of successes that you need in order to affect change. And back to your point, yes, you have to look. I've always said you don't need to look 6 months or a year ahead of anyone else. 1 minute. You just need to look one fraction of a second around the bend ahead of other people to see what's coming and anticipate.
Is it true that, you know, in business leadership is what is intuitive in business is counterintuitive in politics. Meaning, if you say to somebody in business, here's what I'm going to do, here's how I'm going to do it, and here's when I'm going to get it done, that's respected. But you have people when you do that as a politician, again, not getting political, but when you do the same list as a politician, you have advisors going, don't say that.
No.
Don't.
Yeah.
Why?
Well, I don't have advisors.
No, not you. You understand what I'm saying. There's people in your ear.
I shouldn't say that. I have very smart people on my team. But the good thing is we don't make decisions based on politics. But you're right. But you know why? Because people are afraid. Mm-hmm. Because it's natural within us. It's human nature. It's not to pick on people. But some people are just more fearful of change and of disruption and of controversy than are other people. And I'm grateful that I'm just wired to be less concerned about those things. And it's just the nature of what things are.
You mentioned a few minutes ago eating last, so I'm going to test you on something. Assuming you eat last at home.
Sometimes.
Tell us about your kids.
My kids are awesome. I mean, my children are all at home. They're all teenagers and under. The 19 down to 8. Dan the man is 8 years old. He's the baby of the bunch. But they're incredible. They're gifted in many ways. Our oldest daughter has a real gift for, perfect scores on her English ACT and literature. Just a brilliant mind, very creative. She's a great photographer and videographer, and her passion is to have her own business doing high-end wedding videography. And she's just very great at everything. Her younger sisters joked that when she was born, she took everything and left the scraps for the rest of them. So she's great. And then the twins who just graduated from high school, one's going off to school to study nursing. Another one's going off to study accounting and business. Then I have a rising junior. I have a rising sophomore. And then two rising eighth graders, a rising sixth grader, and a rising third grader. Six girls and three boys. I have 7 teenagers right now, including 6 teenage daughters in my home at the same time. And it's just...
So you got a lot of cars you're going to have to buy here soon.
You need to have 24 bathrooms.
It's so funny. Even when we moved into the mansion for a time, although we are there sometimes, but we really stayed in our own home ultimately. But for a time, full time, we moved into the governor's mansion, and everybody was concerned. There'd never been so many children, 9 children. And they said, are there enough bathrooms and enough rooms for everybody? Does everybody have a bedroom? I said, we've never owned a home where everyone had their own bedroom. That's crazy. I shared a bedroom with my 3 brothers my whole life. I was in my 20s before I had my own room.
I had, oddly enough, I had a rental property. I had a Japanese family live in my rental property. Had 4 bedrooms, 2.5 baths. They all lived in one master bedroom.
Yeah.
Just because that's what they were used to. And it wasn't odd. It wasn't weird. Yeah. That's how they felt comfortable.
Yeah. And again, it's all what you make of it. So my kids have always shared bedrooms and bathrooms. When I was a kid, as I said, there were 8 of us, my parents and 6 kids. We had one bathroom. We never had a shower. We had just one bathroom. I had a big old tub in it. And so even then... I remember, sometimes there was a You know, like you'd be like, come on already. Come on. Somebody, you know, we got to use the bathroom. Like, so fortunately, we have more than one bathroom, I'll say that.
I had three sisters, so yeah, I'll just God leave it you. There. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, it's exactly.
I had none until we until mom and dad adopted them. So yeah. you talk about I guess, a contrarian viewpoint towards the career politician, right? And I assume you still abide by that. And you're here to do what you can for the next 2 years. And as far as you're concerned, hopefully another four, I assume. Then what? What is your ultimate goal for? I mean, you've been successful in the business world. You're governor of the state of Kentucky, Commonwealth of Kentucky. Sorry. What's next?
I've always told people. I mean, my Christian faith defines my worldview. It just does. The Judeo-Christian principles with which I was raised and that I have attempted to live my life by define how I think as a husband, as a father, as a business person, and now as a politician. And not everybody shares those with me, but I've been very unapologetic about the fact that it does define my worldview. To that end, I believe in being obedient to what you're supposed to do. Mm-hmm. I really do. I think that you don't just do what you want to do or what you feel like doing.
It's a calling.
Sometimes, and yet I'll tell you honestly, I hate to say it, but anyone who's ever said, God called me into politics, I always throw up a little in my mouth.
I really understand that.
Because I think if he really did, you won't need to tell anyone.
That's right.
Really, if he really truly spoke to you one morning and told you, you just keep your mouth shut, it's going to be obvious.
Yeah. Well, so same with being a Christian
and
in general.
Exactly. And I don't mean to be dismissive.
Sure.
Because I truly think people have callings,
yeah.
You know, spiritually and otherwise. But I do believe in being obedient to what you're supposed to do.
Yeah.
And for me, this is not a path I would have chosen. I never studied even 1 minute of political science in any course in my life. I never aspired to this. I never worked on a campaign. I never worked for a politician prior to being one. And I just believe that our founders, who wanted citizen legislators, who looked at the form of government they came from and intentionally rejected the House of Lords,
mm-hmm.
which was an entitled class of people who got there because someone had been there before
right.
them, they had intentionally rejected that. They wanted citizen legislators, people like us who stepped up from our ranks for finite periods of time to serve, to give some portion of their lives, fortune, sacred honor, do it for a finite period of time, and then go back to from wherever you came from. That is what we have been missing. That's what I believe. I'm willing to do it for a period of time, and we'll see. The future will take care of itself. I don't worry about it politically.
I want to go back to the dignity of work. Because I just, it's kind of interesting when you look at trends in society right now. I've seen studies about how people aren't loyal to companies anymore. And frankly, let's be honest, companies aren't all that loyal to people anymore. And so there's a changing, shifting workforce out there. And I've always lived my life by the philosophy that if you are the CEO of yourself incorporated, then you treat your boss like your customer and you work like your product. And if you do that, everything will be okay. Because I have similar upbringing, the dignity of work. But that's something that, like, you put out a video about this, and you kind of choked up a little bit when you were talking about it. I mean, you earned the money for your first bike.
Yeah.
Kind of walk us through how you developed that life philosophy and how it applies.
Sure. I mean, when I was a kid, again, my parents didn't have any financial resources to share with their children. Truth be told, I feel bad. My dad hopefully won't hear this, but, I mean, I don't want him to feel bad if he does. I would be willing to bet I lent my parents more money growing up than they lent me, which was fine, because I was always working from the time I was a kid. My parents would say, there's jobs around here, but if you want to earn money, we never got an allowance. They said, find a neighbor that'll pay you to do something.
Yeah.
And so from the time I was 6 years old, I literally was always entrepreneurial. I started by repackaging seeds and greeting cards and stuff like that. I would buy like 10 box sets of cards, and I had this idea that who always wants, you know, 10 or 12 cardinals? You know, on their Christmas card. What if you had a cardinal, a Christmas tree, a wreath, and, you know, a manger scene? So I would buy all these box sets, and I'd shuffle them up and make an assortment, and I'd resell them, and I'd mark it up a little bit. And so I was always, when I was 6, 7 years old, I would do this. And so I was always, so when I got to be a little older and wanted a nice 10-speed bicycle, I bought it myself. I had to earn the money. And I remember exactly where I bought it. I remember exactly what I paid. I remember exactly the brand. I remember the name of the store.
Yeah, you said that in the video.
And the reason I remember these things is because I had skin in that game. And the thing I've always said to people who buy their own bike don't leave it out in the rain.
And you said that. You never left it out in the rain.
And I didn't
That's what
leave
stuck
it out in the rain.
Me.
And if I did, if I came home from work and it had gotten wet because I was riding home in the rain,
yeah.
We had a porch. And we didn't have a garage, but I'd put it on the porch. I'd turn it upside down. I'd slowly turn the chain, and I'd dry the chain off and dry the sprocket. And I'd make sure that I dried the little cables where the gears were because I wanted the thing to stay in good condition. And this is what we're robbing people of. You know, when we came in back in the 60s and we offered people solutions from the government, which was the government was going to be the alternative to you doing for yourself, there have always been people in need. But the Great Society has been less than, and the war on poverty has hardly solved that problem. I mean, Lyndon Johnson stood on a porch in Martin County, Kentucky, which was the epicenter of Appalachian poverty. It still is in Martin County, Kentucky. And the reason being is that the government is not the solution, and people giving you something is not the solution. And the best thing you can give someone is the opportunity to do for themselves. Give someone an on-ramp to the American dream.
You said, you know, about the money that you probably loaned your parents more so than they've loaned you. But isn't that part of the American dream that you'd be able to do that?
Sure.
That because of what they invested in you, yeah. You were able to take and invest and have that. It's a possibility. It may not always happen, but it's a possibility that because you've furthered it, now you can give back. Now you can take your parents in. Now you can move them to Kentucky when you become governor.
But they moved themselves. I mean, don't get this wrong. It wasn't like little Jimmy.
Well, I understand.
Little Maddie goes down to the salt mine, comes back, gives a paycheck for that. I mean, really, it wasn't
quite that bleak.
There are some people who really did grow up that way. I mean, I really was blessed. But what I'm saying is like just loaning my dad money for gas or something. Like, we need gas. Anybody have any money? And, you know, I always had money because I always worked. I started working 20 to 30 hours a week at least by the time I was 11 years old. I've been paying Social Security since I was 13 years old. When I get my annual statement, it goes back uninterrupted till I was 13. Mm. And I don't even know how it was legal that I was paying Social Security when I was 13.
Yeah,
but I'm not
sure 13,
14, 15, 16, right. 17 every year because I always worked. And the reason I did is because there is dignity in work. There's satisfaction that comes when you lay your head down at night and you did something constructive. I mean, and it makes you feel good to do for yourself.
Is there a day that sticks out in your 2 years as governor that you laid your head down and thought today was a good day of work? Something you got passed, a bill you were able to sign?
A lot of days. Think about it. When you pass right to work, when you pass laws protecting unborn innocent lives, when you pass laws removing, you know, prevailing wage, which is a waste of $150 million worth of taxpayer money for no constructive purpose. You know, when you start to make change on bureaucracy and you cut red tape, when you bring school choice or the possibility of it to a community that is desperate, where parents and students have no alternative but failure for decades, every one of those is a great day. When you bring a change into an environment of foster care and adoption, where you start to realize we're going to break down these barricades and we're going to make it possible for children in Kentucky to be streamlined and not to take 3 years from the time they're eligible for adoption to be adopted, that's a great day. Every day is a great day. A day is what you make of it. Attitude is everything. I tell this to my children. I don't always embody it myself to the degree I could. It's hard not to be cynical and negative. But trust me, I mean, politics will beat you
more
down.
More so now than it used to be.
But attitude is everything. I was just wearing yesterday, I was doing some work in the evening, and I had a T-shirt on that my wife got me. It's the little glass, and it says half full. And I've always been a half full person. And the reason being, I'll share with you, I mean, let's just say that your chance of doing anything and succeeding is 50-50.
Right.
And probably on average in life, that's about true.
Yeah.
And let's just say that the point at which you determine if you're going to succeed or fail is halfway through the venture, the undertaking. If you go in always assuming you're going to win, then you feel like a winner 75% of the time, even though you're really only a winner 50% of the time. If you go in always assuming you're going to lose, you win 50% of the time, but you feel like a loser 75% of the time. So I always assume I'm going to win. I always go in with the mindset that we're going to be successful. I know we're not. I know maybe it'll only be 50%. But on average, I feel like a winner 75% of the time. And I'm telling you, all else being equal, sometimes that attitude is the difference. It's sometimes the tipping point between winning or losing. Maybe it's where 83 votes come from in a primary.
Right.
Because you just hustled a little harder, you worked a little harder, you don't get outworked. That's one thing I'm grateful for. I don't get outworked.
I've heard a lot of people talk about how, you know, you make your own luck and all that kind of thing. And I've never believed in luck. I don't know how you guys are with it. But I think what they mean when they say that is, because I agree with you, I think when you get up in the morning and you expect to win, you're seeking opportunity and you don't even realize it. You know, you're speaking victory. And when you start out speaking victory, because here's the way I look at it is, everybody knows the people who are pessimists in their circle, right? I mean, you know, yeah. right? And you know your
optimist. Because you push them to the outside of your circle.
Right. So if you're thinking to yourself, which of my two friends is going to go do something that's an opportunity? The yeah. pessimist or the optimist? Who gets the opportunity? Right? I mean, I think that's kind of exactly. It's kind of where we're... Innovation, for you know, we've kind of taken this through the politics side of it, but as a business guy, I thought it was kind of innovative that you take a look at, you know, the company did the cost-serving thing by putting all the red cardinal cards in a box,
yeah.
and you innovated by saying, man, people might want a variety. You know, what is that secret? What is that secret to innovation
maybe
from your
Maybelline.
Perspective?
No, I mean, I don't know. I don't, in all seriousness,
Governor wears makeup. That's the headline in the Courier-Journal on Monday.
It's funny. You think maybe it's this, maybe it's that. I think you're born a certain way. It's often been said, can you train someone to be an entrepreneur? You can train them, but you can't make someone into an entrepreneur. You can't.
Yeah.
I'm one of six children. Some of my siblings, we all grew up in the same house, raised by the same parents. We were all born to them, and we're just wired differently. I've always been a little more entrepreneurial, and it's not necessarily good or bad. If everybody was that way, the world would be crazy.
Yeah, we wouldn't have nurses. We wouldn't have, you
no,
know
exactly.
I mean, we wouldn't
I
have
mean,
there's certain things.
I've always been a bit of a free-range chicken. I always have been from the time I was a kid. I thought that way. I've always... chafed a little bit under, you know, we've always done it that way.
Yeah.
To me, that's just a poor excuse for
why
you do something.
I hate that phrase.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, to me, and another thing that's funny, phrases that I hated, when I was in the military, and ever had a soldier tell me, well, sir, it's good enough for government work?
Yeah.
Oh, that would set me off. As a taxpayer, that would just set me off. I would be like, nonsense.
Why did you choose the military? I mean, what was it about that? This is my next step.
It was twofold. Number one, it helped me pay my way through school with an ROTC scholarship. But I was a decent student. I was blessed with of necessity. I knew if I was going to go to college, I'd have to pay for 100% of it.
Yeah.
So I was a good student in high school, and I had an equivalent number of scholarships that were not ROTC that would have paid for tuition.
Okay.
I worked full time when I was in school, about 20 to 30 hours a week. I was, you know, as a varsity athlete, I was in ROTC full time. I worked 20 to 30 hours a week, and sometimes I went to class. And but it got through, and I knew I was going to do something, but I always wanted to serve. And I don't come from a long family history of people in the military. I just said, all else being equal, I don't think I'll ever look back and regret having served. And that, I'll tell you what, you asked about things I've heard, you know, that most moved me or things that most irritated me or what have you. One thing that I have learned. You asked about lessons learned in politics.
Right.
And I would say to every young man and woman that is listening to this broadcast, if you have a chance to serve your nation in uniform, as a police officer, as an EMT, as a firefighter, or in the military, serve your nation and your fellow citizens in uniform. You will never look back and regret having done it. I've met more people my age in the second half of life who wish they had. Mm. And you will never regret serving other people.
What did you do in the military?
I was an artillery officer. My control branch was military intelligence. So had I made a career of it, I would have stayed in as a foreign area officer in kind of a liaison at some embassy somewhere between the military and the political ranks. But that was my track. My control branch was MI, military intelligence. But my detail branch on the 4 years I spent in active duty was in the combat arms in the field artillery. So I was a division counterfire officer, was my primary responsibility. I was responsible for directing all the incoming and outgoing fire from artillery and, you know, howitzers and MLRS.
So you know fire cannons.
Those are big guns.
You got to play with cannons.
Yeah, no, literally, I mean, putting steel on target. Yep. You know, drop 550, you know, drop 50, you know, 5-0, fire for effect over. These are the kind of things.
This is the kind of thing I'd like to have in my backyard, I'm just saying.
Yeah, I mean, but...
No. The gun, yes, not the shells.
Neither the neighbors nor whoever right, you hit 2 miles away would be appreciated. But I tell you what, it seems remote. It seems like a whole nother world. Like, how can that be applicable, putting steel on target? But my gracious, you learn as a young man. You know, I was in my early 20s, and I have, you know, millions of dollars worth of equipment and scores of people reporting to me and just enough rope to hang myself.
Right.
And you have to learn to lean on the non-commissioned officers, the enlisted people who've been around forever, who are making stuff happen. You have to learn from them even though they report to you. You have to be respectful. You have to listen. You have to realize you have two ears and one mouth for a reason. And so I have many lessons that were learned in the military. I'm grateful to have done it. I'm glad I did it. I'm glad I got out. But I would do it again in a minute.
What is it like? Everything about you since we met, and we met about a year or so ago at that leadership summit with Dr. Moeller and Southern Seminary. But when you slow down, which strikes me as rarely, What do you do? Because you've got to. I mean, you read.
Yeah, read.
What do you read?
Everything. Mostly fiction, and mostly nonfiction, I should say. I don't have time. I enjoy fiction. I just don't have a lot of free
history.
History. I love history. I love biographies and autobiographies. My high school yearbook quote, I was always this way. I mean, when I was a kid, in addition to reading all about orphans, I always read biographies and autobiographies of everybody. Name a person, I probably read their biography
Stalin.
When I was a kid. Stalin. I mean, I'd studied the Bolshevik Revolution. I looked at 1917. I wrote a paper on this in high school.
Yeah.
Because, again, what moves – if entire portions of world history are moved by an individual, what motivated them?
Yeah.
What was their inspiration? How did they grow up? I was always intrigued by how people grew up. And my high school yearbook quote was a quote from Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. If you look on my page, my high school yearbook pictures, my little picture in a shirt that incidentally came to us in a box, because that's almost all the clothes I had growing up were hand-me-downs from someone else.
Right.
And so literally it's
mission barrel, or as my dad said,
mission
barrel.
You were the second of six kids.
I
so
was.
You're, it's your kid,
no,
it's
yeah.
your it's
and
your brothers
also
and sisters.
The tallest, so I never got anybody's anything. but I was
Johnny
in a,
short
I,
pants.
I remember it was my favorite shirt, and it's really kind of not a very nice shirt, but it was my favorite shirt at the time. But my quote was,
you can't tell us what it was.
Lives of great men all remind us we can make our lives sublime, and in passing, leave behind us footsteps on the sands of time. And I have always been curious about what footsteps others have laid down, whose footsteps am I following, and who's following in my footsteps. And this is another thing I tell young people all the time. You're following somebody, whether you're trying to or not, whether you think you are or not, but someone's following you.
Yeah.
And you better be intentional, you better be focused, and you better be mindful of the fact that there is someone behind you, someone younger, someone older, someone your age, who's watching you.
You are somebody's role model.
Whether you want to be or not, whether you think you are or not. Yep. In whose footsteps are you following, and who's following you?
It's probably the most impactful piece of, I guess I'd call it a poem or a literature that's ever, other than the Bible, has been a poem that was in the men's locker room at UK, basketball locker room, called Little Eyes Upon You. And it basically goes, there are little eyes upon you, and they're watching night and day. There are little ears that quickly take in every word you say, little hands that forever do everything you do, and little boys and girls who are dreaming of the day they'll be like you.
Exactly.
And that's exactly what you're saying. By the way, when I said you have to tell us what it is, I meant the shirt you were wearing, not the Longfellow quote.
Oh, it was just a button-down little plaid kind of shirt. I mean, this is the
mid-80s. Oh, when you said it wasn't a nice shirt, you meant it wasn't a nice shirt.
No, it was just an old threadbare shirt. Someone else threw it away.
I thought it was like a Kiss shirt or something.
Oh, no. It just was just a...
We've got about 5 minutes here. Two-part question on the biography thing. What is your favorite biography that you've read, and who of all the biographies that you've read is most like you?
Boy,
or
that's
are
a,
you
that's,
most
that's
like?
Brutal. I mean, it's a combination of many things. It's hard to pick a favorite biography. I read one recently. It's been maybe a couple years now. The Wright Brothers by McCulloch. It's just a fantastic read.
Yeah, he's a really good biographer.
He's an incredible biographer. He's written 1776 and a variety of other things.
Yeah.
But he wrote
Truman, didn't he?
He did. He's written a lot of them. Yeah. The Wright Brothers is a worthy read. If you're curious about anything at all about the dawn of aviation, that was fantastic. I read one years ago on Milton Hershey. That was fascinating. That really stays with me. Churchill, everybody from Stephen Foster to, Booker T. Washington is one I read as a boy that always really moved me. George Washington Carver, you talk about a great guy. I once rode my bicycle across the United States. I pedaled 3,800 miles from Oregon to Florida. And I did it with a couple friends, and at one point we're in the middle of nowhere, like in Kansas, and so we would play 20 questions. And I would always use like some historical figure, and it was funny because these guys would be like, Ben, what? Where do you get this stuff from? And I would pick guys like George Washington Carver. They're like, who is that? But anyway, you talk about great, brilliant, innovative, disruptive minds that have changed forever the history of the world. Those are the kind of people I'm agnostic. I may agree with them. I may disagree with them. It may be a Stalin or
a Lenin
or some of these other people who
learn what not to do from people.
Of course.
But nobody ever wrote a biography about someone who wasn't a disruptor.
Yeah. Somebody, you said, who influenced me the most? Somebody once asked me if you could have dinner, and you could invite three people, who would be at dinner with you?
And okay, I remember, Cameron, Leland, and sure.
This was before sure, I sat right. down with you guys. This is what I said. I said I would invite Jesus Christ, mm-hmm. Abraham Lincoln, and Winston Churchill.
Oh, hold on. I met Jesus Christ at Waffle House one time, 3 o'clock in the morning. I've already had that.
Jesus was Elvis working the grill. Elvis in the back working the grill.
You just met him. You didn't get him to dinner.
We had a waffle.
That's a whole other thing.
We had a waffle. He loaned me a book.
But could you imagine the conversation you would have? I mean, just people who've been at key moments in time.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, and again, that's hypothetical. I mean, who am I most like? I'm a person who perseveres. I'm a person who comes from humble circumstances, but so do a lot of people, including the two of you guys. I mean, there's nothing unique about that. It's what you make of what you're handed.
Yeah. And if you have any other questions.
Just kind of one more, kind of wrapping up as far as, because there's a lot that I would guess the answer to this, but I don't want to. I want you to answer it. Assuming, and you may not, assuming you write an autobiography at one point. I mean, you've been governor of Kentucky. You certainly have the cachet to do that. And you may have had the cachet to do that even before because of your business successes. What would be the overriding, if you could pick one-word theme for your autobiography, what would it be?
Suck it up.
No, I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding.
That's three words. That's three words.
I'm going to give you two words.
Okay.
Be bold. Be bold. We live in a world of sheep.
Yeah.
We live in a world that's completely and continuously being emasculated at every turn. And I say that not to be offensive to anybody of a different gender. And I don't mean to make it even singularly specific to a gender. I'm just saying that boldness, conviction, you know, we're being told constantly that if you have a closely held opinion about anything, keep it to yourself. Right. Don't offend anybody.
Right.
Nonsense. The greatness of the world has always been the discourse of ideas where people came together. Think about the founders of this nation. When they got together in the summer of 1789, you had the Madisons and the Jeffersons and the Hamiltons and all these people. Some of these people hated each other.
Yep.
And they really despised one another and they disagreed. But it was interesting. One of the most agnostic among them, Benjamin Franklin, literally stood up finally when they couldn't agree and said, listen, for crying out loud, have we forgotten where we came from? We used to pray about things. We used to come together realizing higher authorities than ourselves were in charge. And we have forgotten where we came from and the path that we've taken. Maybe we should go back to that. It was Benjamin Franklin who exhorted them to do it. They said, okay, great. Let's pray for 3 hours. They opened that next session with 3 hours of prayer. They weren't all pious, you know, goody-goody people, but they realized if we're going to be great, we need to be great together, and we better have a higher purpose than our own self-interest. And we are losing our touch with that. We are removed from it because we're being told at every turn to keep your mouth shut and just agree with that. Diversity, everyone loves diversity as long as your idea of it is not diverse from mine.
That's right.
Which
right.
is crap. It's nonsense. And so to me, I think the most important thing to understand is that we need to be bold. And to be unapologetic about things that we have strong conviction in, recognizing someone may come with a 180-degree, bold, strong conviction from the other side. Mm-hmm. And we need to respectfully meet them in the middle. But the reality is we don't back down and we don't apologize. And I think the greatness of America was built on these principles, and the future greatness of this nation will be necessarily dependent upon them as well.
All right, last thing. I'm fascinated with CEOs, executives of states that, you know, you guys are incredibly busy, and anybody who is a disruptor is going to be a busy person by necessity. How do you manage your time?
It's sadly more reactive than I wish that it was by dint of the job that I'm in.
Right.
When I was the CEO of a company and of my own company, I had much more control. I've started, you know, or been the lead investor in more than a dozen different companies. Some that I've started as an idea in my basement that have grown into companies that have generated hundreds of millions of dollars in payroll and goods and services and in things. And that's the greatness of America. But there you can be intentional and you can make decisions. In the public sector, you serve the public. You serve people and you respond to them. And sometimes I find myself going to funerals I never would have gone to. Mm. I mean, people wonder why everyone gets gray hair. Yeah. You take on the heartbreak and the heartache of a whole lot of people that you don't necessarily even know or did not know. And so you manage your time in response to the needs of the people you serve in public service.
So how do you balance that with the responsiveness that's required from the job, but also the other requirement, and that is that you are the executive of the state, meaning you're responsible. We elected you to set the vision. So how do you balance the reactive with the proactive.
You have to have a vision. It's been said, without vision, the people will perish. It's true enough. And I've been very clear from the beginning. You put things in writing. You spell them out. You hire people of good character who are competent, who are committed to serving. You give them the authority, not just the responsibility. You give them responsibility. Of course, you hold them accountable, but you give them the authority to make decisions in their own right. And a leader needs to make command-level decisions so that when it all comes down, you hear from people who you trust, who you have empowered. But when the hard decisions have to be made, you step up and you make those decisions. In a time that probably is the most poignant of this is that what happened in the hours immediately after what happened in Marshall County.
Yeah.
And I won't go through all that other than to say I walked into a room where there are still bodies on the floor. There's a chaotic scene, the likes of which I wouldn't even want to try to describe to you. And it's gut-wrenching. Mm. And you have people who've spent their whole lives in the ATF who were there, and the FBI, and who are sheriffs, and who are state police, and everyone's in shock. Mm. And at that moment in time, even though it's a room full of leaders and a room full of seasoned, accomplished, competent people, someone needs to step up and take ownership of that and say, this is what we're going to do. This is what we're not going to do. This is how we're going to create an environment in which we don't sensationalize this, in which we don't turn this into a three-ring circus for the media, in which we allow an environment for this community to heal and to move forward. And that's an example of the kind of things that leaders have to do and that governors have to do. And what prepares you for that? Life prepares you for that. Not learning it in a book, right. Having served other people, having grown up in certain ways, having worked certain ways, doesn't make you perfect. But all these things help to prepare you for making command-level decisions. And so I'm just grateful to be able to serve. I truly am.
Cameron?
I'm good.
What's on your iPod?
I've got everything from the Eagles to Imagine Dragons to Mercy Me, Casting Crowns, David Gray.
An eclectic mix.
It's a very eclectic mix.
Yeah. Really, I like that.
It's a very good.
You like Third Day?
I do like Third Day.
Can't believe they're doing their farewell tour. Yeah, it's driving.
Are they really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, it sucks, man.
Yeah, they've been around a long time.
They've been around 20, 30 years.
Yeah, yeah. 20 plus, exactly. They're solid. There's a lot of good talent. I mean, here's the thing. I'm amazed at how many great musicians nobody's ever heard of. Guster. Yeah. I don't know if you've ever heard of a little band called Guster. Incredible talent.
Yeah.
Incredible talent. In these guys, I remember, anyway, we could have a long conversation about music. I love music. I love people who are talented. I play the piano a little bit, but not, you know.
One of the biggest regrets of my life is that I'd never learned to play the piano. I'd like to be able to play an instrument competently other than the trumpet.
I play just enough for people to think I play the piano.
Exactly. Yeah. I think that's all I really want to.
I took lessons, and the only thing I remember is chopsticks. So, Governor Matt Bevin, it's been a pleasure. Appreciate it.
Appreciate it, guys.
A lot of fun, and we appreciate you all tuning in to The Disruption Zone. I'm Leland Conway. That's Governor Matt Bevin and Cameron Mills.